We made this.
Hello and welcome to The Time Is Now, Soylent Green is People. My name is Kurt North and today we are discussing Millenniums, Episode 2, Season 1, Gehenna. But before we do that, we need to introduce our guest, and today I have with me Darren Mooney. Now Darren, I have a one-time offer of a new hair care product for you. It's free. All you need to do is provide me with your address and credit card number. Is that okay?
That sounds like a good deal, Kurt. That sounds like a good deal.
Excellent.
The only question is, I'm worrying, do I need hair care products when I'm getting to that age? You know?
We are talking about Gehenna, which is written by Chris Carter and directed by David Nutter. It was released on the 1st of November, 1996. Now, as we have done in various other podcasts, we see what the rating is on IMDb. Have you had a look at this one?
I have not. I have not cheated.
Okay, so we have this one at a 7.6 out of 10, bottom third. I think it's 6 episodes from the bottom. So
of the first season, is it?
Of the first season, yeah.
That would probably be somewhere in the right kind of region. I'm generally, like, I mean, I talked about this on the pilot. Like, I absolutely adore Millennium in general. I love the pilot. I think the pilot's one of the best episodes of television that Chris Carter ever produced. I really adore the second half of the season. I think once you get to the thin white line, the season, or even Force Majeure, the first season just really takes off and starts firing in sort of all cylinders. I think that run through the second half of the first season and into the second season is one of the best seasons and a half of television ever produced. But I do think that means that if you are ranking the season, your bottom half is probably going to be culled from the first half of the season. Now, I think Gehenna is maybe a bit stronger than a lot of the other episodes in this first stretch. Because, again, this is the thing where you have, I think Todd Vanderwerf, who's the TV critic at Vox, and he also, I think, recapped Millennium at the AV Club. He's talked about how when you're making a TV show, what you do is you remake the pilot 6 times. Or at least that's how you used to do it back when you did 20-odd episodes. And, sometimes that works well if your format is so broad that you can remake the pilot 6 times. You just swap in, say, a different alien each time or a different monster each time. It doesn't work quite as well when you're well, we'll swap in a different kind of serial killer each time.
Yeah.
And I think that Gehenna sort of there's a lot to like in Gehenna, but there's points at which it demonstrates things that I think will be an issue for Millennium going forward, perhaps.
So saying that, what sort of out of 10, what would you give the episode?
I'd probably give it a 6. I'm I'm probably a bit harsher a marker than IMDb because, again, the ceiling and the floor in IMDb, is very high, so to speak. If you're getting a 7.6 and you're in the bottom third of the season, you know, that's not an even distribution of where it's going. I would argue that there are ones and twos that are to be found in the first season. So a 6 actually isn't that bad as far as things go. It's a little above average. It's not an episode that I would single out as being particularly brilliant on its own, but I think that it's well made and it's got enough good ideas that sort of elevated above some of the elements that I think don't quite work as well, if that makes sense. So I think a 6 would be about right for me. What about you, Kurt?
Yeah, I mean, I would give it probably just slightly high. I would say maybe a 6.5, potentially 7. I think it's a solid episode. I think that it kind of reemphasizes what happens in the pilot to a degree and kind of reinforces it in a lot of ways. And it's a perfectly acceptable episode to get you into the feel of what Millennium is going to be moving forward. And one of the things I was going to mention, actually, was I think that David Nutter in the commentary does actually say that they wanted to keep the aspects of what had happened in the pilot and the visual feel and how the show went forward, and, you know, to give it its uniqueness. And you know, when you saw a Millennium episode, you know what that would be. agree. I mean, I don't know what you feel about that, but I'd certainly feel that they did have a certain set theme that they had running, especially the first half of the season, especially.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, the thing with the pilot is that the way a television pilot works generally is that you have a significant amount of time to go off and do it. You can go off into the wild. You can basically cast your actors. You can write your script. You spend as long working on that script as you do on any script you'll work on for the show. You have to pitch it. It goes through multiple iterations. There's a lot of work before the pilot even gets made. And then there's a gap in post-production. There's a lot of time before you show it to executives and get feedback. And then you get a green light to the series. So making a pilot is a very different experience from making a weekly show. And I think that I even might have mentioned it last week, where you had stuff like Carter paying out of his own pocket to reshoot scenes from the pilot because he thought that they didn't work well enough the first time around. The problem or the challenge facing any show when you're doing a second episode is how do you do what you spent all that time and effort doing in the pilot and find a way to do it on a weekly basis for, you know, for 20 odd weeks of a year. Although, to be honest, you're probably producing for somewhere close to 30 weeks of a year. And how do you get that rhythm down? How do you find a way to take that polished sheen that you sold with the pilot, having all the time, not all the time in the world, but having more time and a little bit more money, and do that on a tighter budget, on a tighter schedule, and with stricter limitations? And I think that Gehenna, I think you're right in terms of, like, Gehenna proving that you can do that, and proving that, like, the language of Millennium is not just confined to the pilot. The pilot is one of the most cinematic episodes of television, I think, from the 90s, if we're being entirely honest. I think only the Twin Peaks pilot comes close to it in that sort of terms. But, like, doing that week in and week out was always going to be a challenge. I think Gehenna shows that you can. I don't think it's as polished. I don't think it's as fine. I don't think it's as good an episode as the pilot is. But I think it takes enough from it in terms of technique. And you're right, the sense of theme that runs through it, but even little things like the way it's directed, those like intercutting sequences with the monster that are really disturbing, the idea of bringing across serial killers and finding a way to do a slightly different serial killer each week as well on top of that, while playing into like the core themes of the sort of, you know, the apocalypse is looming in the background but never being overt. Like, I mean, it's very much like what Deep Throat did on The X-Files, because you have the pilot and you have Deep Throat, and many people would argue that, like, the pilot and Deep Throat should be seen as, like, a loose two-parter. Like, you can only really get a sense of what The X-Files is going to be by looking at those two episodes. And, I mean, then you have, like, Squeeze right afterwards, which is the first monster of the week, and it's, like, in those three episodes, that is The X-Files. And I think the pilot of Millennium is more fully formed than the pilot of The X-Files. But I think Gehenna does something slightly similar in that regard, in that it's like, how do you take that and do it on a weekly basis, if that makes sense, does it?
It does. Absolutely, it does. I think we should maybe dive further into the episode. So without further ado, let's get a bit deeper into Gehenna. Okay, so we're looking at the opening scene. We have a group of, I'd say, 19, 20-year-old kids driving around into this old industrial site, and they've taken LSD, and one of the victim, as we later find out, is running into the old ruins there, and he sees what becomes a telltale mark in kind of like Frank's vision as such. What did you think of the opener to this one, and especially the aspect of seeing the flashes the way that Frank Black would see him, and the point of view that we're seeing that from?
Well, I mean, the thing about the pilot, and particularly about Gehenna in general, is that it's steeped in Carter's pet interests and pet themes. And you can see that running through. Like Chris Knowles, who has done a lot of great work over on the X-Cast, and who hopefully I may be talking to at some point during the run of this podcast as well, about Millennium. He's written a great deal about, like, for example, Carter's interest in psychedelic substances that recurs throughout his work. I'm thinking, for example, like the is it Demons at the end of the fourth season has Mulder trepanning himself, for example, but you have the psychedelic fungus, you have in Field Trip, you have stuff like Mulder's hallucinations in Folie à Deux, you have all this sort of stuff that happens with, like, the idea of consciousness expansion and people having their perceptions of reality warped. So, like, it's nice that you have the opening of Gehenna being this idea of, like, taking LSD and as a result of that connecting to something and seeing something monstrous and evil. And again, this is when you mention Frank's visions in particular, this is an interesting thing, and I'm kind of curious first of all, what you make of it, but also, like, one of the great things about listening to this podcast is probably going to be listening to other people unpack and talk about it, because it's one of the great things that that's debated in Millennium fandom with regards to, like, the nature of Frank's visions. Like, here they're likened to that LSD trip, because, like, when you're seeing those visions, they're codified in the style of Frank's visions. Like, it's, you know, as an audience having watched the pilot, that, like, this is what Frank sees. And in case you don't, later on, Frank sees exactly the same thing, but you know that it's not an echo of the LSD trip. So there's a question of, like, when Frank sees what he sees, is that just intuition? Is that just something, is it a device for the audience's benefit in terms of, like, interpreting for us what Frank is seeing, the way that you might, if you were directing a detective movie, use inserts to show, like, oh, look, there's the letter opener that was used. There's the torn shard of cloth that gives away who the killer is. Except this is something more intuitive, psychological, and monstrous. Like, well, this is the face of evil, by the way. Or is it something more haunting and more abstract and more, like, metaphorical? So is it, like, how Frank feels rather than what Frank perceives, if that makes sense? Is it like, this is what evil feels like, except we're on television, so we have to do it using sight and sound. We can't convey a feeling to you. We have to just pound you with images and have you respond to that emotionally and viscerally, which, by the way, it's very effective at doing. I mean, there are stories about people getting nightmares. The censors at Fox, who, like, greenlit the footage frame by frame, talked about when they watched it, they got nightmares afterwards. That's how effective this is. Or is it something more concrete? And again, this is something that I think people are going to talk about when they talk about, like, Millennium. Is Frank actually seeing something that is really there and that is simply concealed to the rest of us? Like, is this guy actually a demon, for example? Or is he being used by a demon? Or is a demon at work in a very literal sense in the world of Millennium? And again, this is something that people push back and forth. And I think Frank Spotnitz has come out, I think, in the really great The Time Is Now, the book that was put out. That one, that, like, in an interview in that, I think Spotnitz was very clear that when they're writing the first season, their point of view was that it was not like that. It was more Frank conveying a sense of what Frank felt. But it is interesting whether or not, like, whether you think that that's literally a demon, metaphorically a demon, or just the use of demonic imagery to make you feel bad. What do you think it is, Kurt? I'm kind of curious.
Yeah, I mean, over the course of the three seasons, they obviously add different aspects. And this is one of the things I was asking, because of the way that they are portrayed in this particular episode, is that you're seeing visions that are not even Frank Black's. You're seeing it either from the victim's point of view or the person who's Clement, who we later learn. Are we getting it from his point of view? So they play around with it in so many different episodes during the course of the first season and second season, especially with the likes of Single Blade of Grass, where they play with it massively. I think personally that I would go from the aspect of that it is a plane that he is getting access to and seeing and being able to enter that world as such to see into that plane and that evil side and what is actually occurring within the minds of that evil presence.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, like, there's a lot in this episode. Again, we talk about, like, standard Carter tropes, but, like, this is the episode that lays out a lot of, like, Carter's stall with regards to evil and the concept of evil as Chris Carter perceives it, which notably is different from the concept of evil that you get in the second season, which is how Glenn Morgan and James Wong see evil. So here, like, again, not to jump too far ahead, but you have this whole discussion about what evil is in the world and whether evil exists within people or outside of people and whether it's something that comes from us or whether it's something that acts through us. And Carter has, like, Carter has form in this regard, in terms of, like, if you look at the X-Files, think of, like, the third, particularly, like, the roots of Millennium in the third season with stuff like, say, for example, the Black Oil in Piper Maru and Apocrypha, but even Grotesque, which is the episode that aired, I think, either directly before or directly after that two-parter, where you have Carter's idea of evil as something that exists outside of us, but which moves through us and contaminates us and sort of, like, alters us in a very fundamental way. And so I guess I can sort of see that idea that, like, it really is a demon and it just happens to be moving through this chemical engineer who presumably worked at this abandoned creepy-ass plant on the edge of San Francisco then was like, hey, when that blew up, I guess I'm founding a doomsday cult. As you do. But as you do. I mean, everybody, like, times are tough, Kurt. Who are we to judge?
Exactly.
But yeah, I think that sort of thing is there. I do also like, just in terms of while we're talking about the teaser, the use of the night vision goggles by the killer, which very firmly anchors this in the idea of Silence of the Lambs. Because again, Silence of the Lambs is the kind of the movie that sort of codified the idea of like night vision serial killer hunting. So I like that even here where you've got demons, you're like, yep, yeah, we're still in the framework of Thomas Harris.
Yeah, or Tom Clancy in Splinter Cell. but also as well, what I jump in right towards the end of the episode, which I find quite an interesting cut, is the when we've got Mike going through to before we get to the microwave, that we see a scene where he's in with the cult tables where they were doing the phone calls, and Mike turns around and sees some cameras, and he looks up at the camera and he sees this lovely night vision CCTV footage, but he's also wearing the night vision goggles watching the CCTV footage, which I quite liked.
Commit to your bit, Kurt.
Exactly. But we move out of the teaser. So obviously that was in San Francisco. We move out of the teaser and we're back at the Yellow House, and one of the first things we see is the neighbor and also the dog, who's obviously grown quite a bit in the short time, so some time has passed here. Now, the neighbour doesn't last that long over the course of the season, but it was obviously there for a bit of light relief, I would have thought. What are your thoughts on his interactions over the course of the episode?
I mean, this is one of the things where, like, again, this is the kind of thing where Millennium fans are sort of like have. And again, I like that Millennium is a show that has room for these sort of debates, even decades after it's ended, where people are like, well, what was the deal with the neighbor after all? Was he being set up to be some sort of like sinister figure down the line? Was there some sort of end game that never materialized? Was he simply like a thematic element that was supposed to represent the idealized world into which Frank was trying to like keep Jordan and Catherine? And I mean, yeah, it's kind of interesting in terms of my own take. I kind of lean more towards the idea that, yeah, he's just this embodiment of like suburban like living and the idea of like the mundane world that exists quite apart from this, you know, the drudge that kind of Frank wades into. I do have a pet theory, which is one of those crazy things that I've got no way of knowing if it was true or if there's any way to validate whether it was true or not. But I do wonder if there is a point later in the season in Lamentations where a character who is important to the show is brutally, brutally murdered. And the reason that character was chosen was for behind the scenes reasons that had to do with the relationship involving the actors on the show. And I do wonder if the original intent might have been towards the end of, if Carter was when he was writing the early drafts of the first season, was like, I'm going to introduce this character who's really nice and really lovable and maybe brutally murder him in the second half of the season. And basically events sort of interceded to mean that the character who got brutally murdered was sort of changed. I do wonder if the happy neighbor character from Gehenna was like slowly stumbling towards a really brutal murder in the second half of the season. But again, I've got no way of knowing.
Could you imagine that? That would certainly be an interesting piece of fan fiction, right there.
Tell me you can't imagine him stumbling into the dark house and being, "Oh, I didn't notice you left your back door open," and then boom.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that would be amazing. That would be shocker. I mean, he's such a love, as you say, a suburban, lovely next door neighbour. He's, you know, especially when he's asking, you know, what do you consult on? What is exactly consulting? especially the fact that it gives that lighter tone. I mean, we're talking about tone, and one of the aspects of Millennium, especially the first few episodes, is to give you that dichotomy of, you know, the Yellow House and the aspects of that, but also the dark work that Frank does, and obviously him being the lightheartedness of it and being an outsider asking those questions, potentially maybe for the audience as well, which I always find quite good. I mentioned about the puppy growing quite a bit. So there's obviously been a bit of time. That's probably from production reasons. I would have thought that the pilot was probably filmed in quite a significant time.
And I mean, the Yellow House has also changed completely as well. Frank's completely refurbished. We just catch him at the end when he's installing those lights. I mean, he's completely remodeled the house based on what we've seen with the pilot. Because again, they found it wasn't possible to shoot at the Yellow House that they used in the pilot. So this is the house I think they used in Deep Throat in the X-Files to give that sort of nice connection back to the first season, which is kind of cool.
We've got Catherine at this point, and we've got the family aspect of the episode, and we see this over the course. I think it's probably just to talk in general over the course of the episode, because there's only a few scenes. The Yellow House being the protected area that Frank needs to protect them. We're also getting the daughter saying, you know, did he get the bad man? And we've got that aspect of it. But we also get Bob Bletcher coming in later on and speaking about the efforts that Frank has gone through and the dark times that Frank has gone through. And I think Catherine mentions the Catcher in the Rye. Those elements are obviously designed to bring the audience back into the show from the pilot. What were your thoughts on those scenes throughout scattered throughout the episode?
This is the thing where I don't want to be too harsh on this, because I understand what you're doing is you're reiterating for the audience and you're setting out a thematic tent in terms of what you're going to do with Millennium going forward. This is Carter stating very simply, this is what the show is about. This is who Frank Black is. This is it's exposition. It's character derived exposition. I also think, though, that it sets up a number of issues that affect the first season going forward. The most obvious one being that Catherine Black is the secondary lead in the show. Megan Gallagher is credited after Lance Henriksen in the credits. She is not necessarily very clearly defined as an individual over the course of the first season. Now, to be fair to Carter, Carter understands that's a priority. He writes The Well-Worn Lock, which is an episode that is structured specifically so Catherine can have a primary role in the narrative. But if you look at the pilot and you look at Gehenna, the issue with Catherine is that she exists as an object for Frank to protect, a princess to be protected in the castle, but also in that scene with Bletcher, which is And again, it's the second episode, first episode after the pilot. I don't want to be too cruel, but it reminds me of that bit in The Simpsons where Homer's on Itchy and Scratchy, and he's like, look, I have a number of suggestions to improve the show. Whenever my character's not on screen, all the other characters should be asking, where's my character? Yeah. And you have that moment where Bletcher and Catherine outline exactly who Frank is and exactly who they are in relation to Frank. And you have these two characters interacting. By the way, that act break, jump, false scare, where there's a silhouette at the door and it turns out to be Bletcher, is terrible. It's a really hacky piece of writing. And again, I say that with a great deal of affection for the show and for the episode, which we'll get to in a moment. But even beyond that, you have this scene with two supporting characters who are played by two great actors. Bill Smitrovich is fantastic.
Yeah.
Megan Gallagher is great as well. But you're just using them to deliver exposition about Lance Henriksen. And Frank Black is great. He's one of my favorite Chris Carter characters. Lance Henriksen is so good, you don't need two of your greatest actors there telling you how great he is, because I'm watching him being great. Why don't you let the other characters have room to breathe and explain who they are? It's less of an issue for Bletcher, because Bletcher is very clearly a supporting character, even if he's not as fleshed out as, say, Skinner on The X-Files, to pick an example. But it's a bigger issue with Catherine, who is technically the secondary lead. Now, she's never going to be the Scully to Frank Black's Mulder, but it does sort of set up the idea, and it's an issue that the show comes back to repeatedly in the first two seasons, of having no idea what to do with Catherine as a character in her own right. And it's not from lack of trying, to be absolutely clear. Again, you have in the first season episodes like The Well-Worn Lock, which are what can we do to bring Catherine into the story that we're telling? You have episodes like Wide Open, where it emphasizes on her work as a social worker, where she's working with kids and she helps contribute to the solving of the case in some matter. In the second season, you have Morgan and Wong actually giving her agency in the narrative and pushing her away from Frank so that she's less defined in the role of Frank's, the princess in the castle. Yeah. And also the introduction of a female character who serves as an equivalent to Frank rather than just as an object in the way that Catherine does. But yeah, it's an issue that the show never really gets past. And that's kind of a huge shame when you have an actor of Gallagher's sort of stature. I mean, she's really great. And it's kind of sad watching this episode and seeing the show primarily just using her as a vehicle to a window into Frank's angst almost, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think you've got an episode in season two as well where they have that secondary lead that comes in actually work with Catherine, yeah. which was another attempt, and they still struggle with it in season three, which is it's right through the whole season. I feel that they've just really, really struggled with her character. Some of the aspects in this episode, though, I think that if they went down this route maybe a bit more and actually have her involved in some conversations, like Frank does have a conversation with her where he's laying it out on the line, you know, and we'll get into this in a little bit about the fact of, you know, kind of what we were saying before about Frank's visions and what are they, and is it evil and is it a person or whatever. She gets into that conversation with him. But there's conversations before that where he's laying it on the line and saying what's happening with her, or she's asking what's happening with him. And it was a really nice little section of dialogue between the two of them. And they just felt that, you know, they didn't get to that point where they were confiding in each other as much as what they could have or should have, yeah, over the course of the season, which would have at least put her on this equal footing with him and actually helping him, drawing him back, yeah, to certain degrees as well.
I mean, the issue there is that, like, even as early as this episode, Gehenna, you have Atkins basically setting up this dynamic where Frank is keeping a secret from Catherine, where he's keeping the Polaroid stalker from Catherine, right? And again, you're right. If you have this, like, your options when you have a married couple like that is you can do one of two things. You can have them working together in harmony and playing off one another beautifully so they understand each other. They finish each other's sentences. They're like, they are two halves of one whole. Or you can do something where there's a gap between them, or there's a schism between them, or there's a ruction between them, and that allows them both to be, like, accented as characters in that you get to contrast the two. So, like, the fact that Frank doesn't tell Catherine about the Polaroids is a very revealing character beat about Frank. It tells us a lot about who Frank is and adds a great deal of complexity to this idea of Frank as somebody who's trying to protect the Yellow House, because it introduces an element of ambiguity. It's like, well, he's lying. He wants to protect Catherine. That's great. I think we all have that where we want to protect the people who are close to us. But he's also doing that by lying to her and by, like, she's clearly uncomfortable and she's clearly nervous and she's clearly got a sense that something's wrong. But he's not communicating to her about it because he thinks that's protecting her. And that creates, like, an interesting ambiguity about Frank, where Frank is trying to do the right thing, just not necessarily in the right way. The issue is that doesn't give Catherine an equivalent push or pull, where Catherine maybe senses something's up, but that's always generally in scenes where she's reacting to Frank and the audience is coming at it from Frank's perspective, as opposed to, and I think you're right, maybe more scenes with supporting characters like Bletcher. Like, if Catherine had more scenes with Bletcher where she could expound upon her own philosophy and her own perspective, that it might help over the course of the season. But I do think that here you're sort of setting the seeds of that, where you have Catherine and Bletcher talking to one another, but talking to one another about how awesome Frank is. And it's like, I get that Frank's awesome. I want to see why you guys are awesome.
Yeah, yeah. And it's only compounded by the unease that Catherine feels when the lights go out outside, as well. I mean, that's compounding that issue. And then obviously then we move into the scene where Catherine and Bob have that conversation. Back to the case, and one of the first aspects of it is that when we have Frank Black come into the crime scene with Peter, we find the ear in the garden in the front section, and we eventually find out that there's traces of LSD and the chemical, which then links them back to the old industrial site, and then they find the teeth, which is then inspected by Peter. What were your thoughts over those aspects of the first part of the episode?
It's kind of interesting in terms of, like, setting the show in San Francisco, because again, this kind of ties back into, and again, the use of LSD there, as I mentioned, with the psychedelia, and that being something Carter is very interested in as a writer. But you have this kind of, like, Millennium's a show about serial killers. It's very clear from the pilot that it's going to be a show about serial killers. And a lot of that is sort of a lot of Millennium's anxiety. I would argue, like, the central thesis of Millennium, The X-Files, is about fear of our past. It's about shame about our past. It's about guilt. It's about the things that we carry from our past that we are ashamed of. So it's about discovering that your parents are not who you thought they were, that the world is not how you thought it was, and that everything that, you know, the world that you live in now is built on crimes and compromises and flaws. In contrast, Millennium tends to be the opposite. It's about fear of the future. It's about worry. It's worrying about how uncertain the future is. Like, it's literally called Millennium, and it was a show produced in the late 90s. It's this idea of looming apocalypse. But I like that in this episode, which is the second episode of the season, you have this like looming anxiety and dread that's rooted in sort of more historical sort of ways. Like, so for example, the pilot was set in Seattle, which is associated with like grunge, where it rains all the time. It's got this sort of like atmosphere. Like, again, it reminds you of Seven, the use of Seattle in the pilot. Here you have them going to San Francisco and discovering a case of like kids dosed up on LSD who joined a cult and were brutally murdered. And, like, that's very, very clearly harking to one specific serial killer that looms large in the American consciousness. I'm thinking, obviously, of Manson, for example. Now, the show does some interesting stuff where it's not quite a Manson family situation. It's very much, it's a very 90s or turn of the millennium version of the Manson family that we end up discovering here. But I like that the show kind of gestures back towards that sort of, like, 60s counterculture. Because, again, like, Millennium is a product of the late 90s, and you had that anxiety in the late 90s around the legacy of the 60s. Like, just look at, like, Forrest Gump, for example. But even stuff around, for example, the Clinton, like, I did a bunch of research for when I wrote a book about the X-Files, just in terms of like the 90s culture, and particularly say Clinton and the impeachment hearings and stuff like that. And there was this huge anxiety about like what the 60s had wrought in terms of American culture, in terms of concepts like the use of drugs, like, but also in terms of like counterculture and in terms of like, you know, free love and that sort of stuff. And watching Gehenna now, I kind of get a little bit of a sense of that in terms of like its use of San Francisco as a setting, its emphasis on like the Manson family sort of LSD stuff. And I mean, like, there's some other past crimes that are very, very consciously evoked as you get towards the climax of the episode as well.
Yeah, I mean, you're right with the San Francisco stuff. I think from reading from your article that Jim Jones spent some time there as well, I believe, as well. So so it's very reminiscent of that. And we've even got the Chechnya and Russia element with as I mentioned there, when Peter Watts and Frank do find the teeth and they find the dental work that's been done on them, which then eventually leads them to the Chechen parents. We get to the father, and the father's holds back this letter that he got from the victim, and the letter is very, very telling in the fact that he is disowning his mother, that he mentions Gehenna, and then Mike Atkins talks about the miscalculation of the millennium, and that's when we get the apocalypse aspect of the show as a whole, and the cult itself. Now, I know that I'm not quite sure if it gets mentioned at this point, but we then link back obviously to the likes of the Tokyo 1995
sarin
attacks and stuff like that. So the cult is a unique one. If you're looking at, you know, I think that Heaven's Gate and was around this time. It was around when, because I was talking about The Field Where I Died when I spoke on that episode. Whether or not that's out yet, I don't know. But that I spoke that around this time, around when Millennium came out and around when The Field Where I Died came out, Heaven's Gate happened. And that was a big influence on me growing up. And these were the shows that were around at the time. And it definitely had an impact on me. And I researched, you know, all kinds of things because off the back of that. But this cult feels very different. It's very... it is more of the Tokyo aspect. It's the commercial side, the fact that they're trying to make money and stuff. So what were your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, that's it. It's kind of interesting in that regard, because it's, again, the presentation of San Francisco and the kind of the death of the 60s and the shadow of the 60s cast, where, like, this is, as I mentioned earlier, a very 1990s cult. It's, as you point out, it's a very capitalist and a very materialist cult. It's like you have like all these quotes from them, you know, with, you know, where Peter Watts is saying he's with his new family now, he must renounce his parents just as he must renounce his belief in anything but the power of the enterprise, and that the power of the enterprise resides in the hearts of the faithful. When I heard that, I couldn't help but think of like the you know, God favors our enterprise written on the dollar bill, for example. But even when they have the kid in sort of custody later on, you know, when he's talking about how that's all there is, phone numbers, serial numbers, card numbers, you and everybody else, that numbers are all we are. It knows the numbers and it knows you. Or they told me we were going to be rich, that we were the chosen ones. It's very much, it's hyper-capitalism. And it's very worth telling that again, that his parents, like the first victim's parents emigrated from Chechnya, from like the former Soviet Union, basically, and came over to America in pursuit of the American dream. I think they moved over in 1990, which would be about the time the Berlin Wall fell, a little bit afterwards. Mm. And the idea that like they came over in the wake of the end of the Cold War, embraced the American dream, and then became like prey for this sort of weird capitalist enterprise. And again, you have that sort of, it's very much like, I love, and again, this is the thing where like the first season of Millennium's really, really dark and really, really broody and really, really serious. And sometimes it's a little bit too serious, but there are moments of like strange, dark comedy sort of buried within. I'm thinking of like the sort of like Apple type advertisement telemarketing cult, yeah, where they have like everybody wants great hair, which is just projected onto the screen in this sort of block capitals as a way of motivating workers who are reading off a script while trying to sell hair care products and get credit card numbers in order to finance their attempt to take over the sort of the country with their machine guns. By the way, again, you're right when you point to like the idea of this tying into sort of contemporaneous anxieties in America with like militias and cults and stuff like that. But you're right in terms of the X-Files around the same time was doing this sort of stuff. You mentioned The Field Where I Died,
yeah,
which is again about another sort of cult with like huge arms sort of reserves and machine guns, but even stuff like say Tunguska and Terma, which are also about militias, or like even Unrequited, the sense that Carter was very much engaged with this sort of fear of what was happening to America at this moment in time. Also worth noting, actually, just in this regard, that like watching Gehenna now, having rewatched all of the X-Files quite recently, again, this is like a sense of Carter's core themes carrying over. Mm. It's not quite the same thing in a very literal sense, but it's the same thing in a very metaphorical sense, in that like this idea of evil as it exists in this like telemarketing cult is very similar to kind of the idea of the syndicate in the X-Files, at least as far as it's framed, where like Frank asks Bob, like, what does it want? You know, the it being the monster that's driving the cult, presumably the demon that Frank's seeing. And Bob responds with obedience and control. And Frank says, in return for what? And Bob responds with, to share in the power when the end comes, when the everlasting fire rages in the year of destiny, when the weak and the indolent perish. And you look at that, and that is exactly what the X-Files conspiracy is revealed to be. Mm. It's a bunch of conspirators who are trying to control the world, who are trying to control people, and who are trying to do that in order to be basically, I think, commandants of the camps is how Mulder describes them in, like, Talitha Kumi, when the end comes. And it's kind of interesting that, like, again, you see Carter's preoccupation simmering through. Like, Millennium and the X-Files, you know, the degree to which they do or don't overlap, particularly in the first season where Carter was, like, outside of the use of extras and, I think, Lamentation, Carter was very, you know, sort of firmly opposed the idea of crossing over between them. Morgan and Wong were a bit more playful with, like, Jose Chung's From Outer Space and with the use of Morley's in the second season finale. Yeah. But, like, Carter was very clear that the X-Files and Millennium were two very different things. But at the same time, even watching Gehenna, there's a sense that, well, are they? Or are they just two different expressions of a lot of the same ideas?
Mm. And you mentioned earlier as well that when we're talking to the kid who gets captured and calls himself Bob Smith, and I think that, correct me if I'm wrong, I think everyone was calling themselves Bob Smith. Yeah. I'm not 100% yeah, sure on that yet. And they start talking about the serial numbers and the numbers. What I found really interesting in that scene and in later scenes in a lot of the episodes is the way that Frank can get onto whoever he's talking to's level and to talk to them directly, whether or not it's because of the visions or just the way that he profiles and the way that he interviews, but he is able to get people to talk, and it's not through a shouty or a pressured way. It's done in the way that he knows. It's almost like saying to them, "I understand what's happening here. You talk to me," kind of thing. Yeah. And I thought that was really telling in that scene where they are talking to him, because he's got his back to them. He won't say anything, and then when Frank comes in, he then starts to make him turn around and give all that speech that you gave just before.
Yeah, and it's really uncanny and uncomfortable as well how well Frank does that. It's the, again, this is the idea of empathy being like Frank's superpower, which is, again, very similar to a Thomas Harris concept with like Will Graham. You know, Frank is very much like Chris Carter's version of Will Graham. He's extremely empathic. He has this ability to emotionally and intuitively understand the people around him. You know, this is part of what pushed him to his mental breakdown. So it's really interesting as an audience to watch, particularly because Lance Henriksen is so good. But it's really uncomfortable to watch Frank have this conversation where, like, again, it just, he drops so easily. Like, Frank's question is not, what does he want? What does the leader want? What does your boss want? It's, what does it want? Mm-hmm. He understands that, like, you know, the cult member is talking about something more primal. Something, and again, it implied to be something that Frank has seen in those quick flashes, which again makes you sort of unsettled. Is worth noting, actually, by the way, just in terms of recurring Chris Carter motifs, this is also very explicitly kind of couched in Nazi imagery as well. There's the moment where Atkins is, like, again, you pointed to the sequence where Atkins is sort of skulking through the remains of the industrial yard, and he sees the night vision camera, but, like, one of the messages that flashes on the screen is, "Work will set you free," which is, again, what was written above, I think, was it Dachau or was it Auschwitz, in German? But the idea of what was written on the camps there. But even stuff like the use of the microwave, or the crematorium as well, is also very much taken directly. Again, like, they cite the example of the cult responsible for the sarin nerve gas attack in Tokyo. But it's also very much, when you see it, an imagery that you associate with Nazism. And again, that's a core Carter fear as well. He suggested it in The X-Files repeatedly as well, particularly in the third season episodes, like, for example, Paperclip and Blessing Way, where the question was, like, if the America won this, what if America won the Second World War in, like, fact, but the cost of that was in surrendering our soul, in taking over these Nazi scientists, but also in, you know, maybe things that we incorporated as a society, as our government, from totalitarian regimes that make us uncomfortable. Mm. And it's kind of, it's interesting to see Carter sort of playing with that here, where you have this idea, again, the cult is American society just taken to its logical extreme. Like, he's running a telemarketing company. He's saying create desire. He's manipulating the market. He's reducing people to credit card numbers and selling hair care products. He's basically, like, everything wrong with American society, if you were that way inclined, if you were going to look at it that way, and sort of weaponized and turned into something monstrous. So I think that's something that's very, very core to Chris Carter's work on both The X-Files and Millennium, and it's interesting to see it distilled here almost in its purest form.
Bob Smith, during that interview, dies, and he effectively dies of fear, although we do get Mike saying, you know, we don't know how much LSD was in him.
Good job, Mike. It's like, thanks for that. Yeah,
it was kind of, it was just a throwaway. Yeah, well, you know, we don't know how much he had in him. It's fine. He just died. So
I love the idea that there was a cut of that where, like, after sort of Frank explains that he died of fear, there's like a crack of thunder and a lightning flash outside, and Atkins, like, yeah, it was like, yeah, that or LSD. This is interesting and something I'm a little bit, again, this is one where I'm not sure what I make of it. I'm kind of curious what you make of it, which is the way that the first season, and particularly the first half of the first season of Millennium, approaches the idea of fear. In that, like, Carter seems genuinely concerned and legitimately concerned, it turns out, like, in some ways presciently concerned about how fear governs the way that we live now. Like, there's a moment where Frank talks about, like, the kid who wrote the letter to his parents saying, "I think he's writing out of fear." There's a moment where Atkins asks Frank, you know, about the Polaroid stalker, "What is the object of terrorism?" And Frank responds, "Terror." And there's the idea that, you know, And even like throughout, you have like Frank calling up his family, calling up Catherine and saying, are you guys all locked up in there? You have him installing the light outside his house, which ironically enough just causes more fear and more anxiety for Catherine when it's triggered by what might be a stray cat. And so you have this sense that Carter is aware of how much fear is part of like modern living. And again, this is in the 90s when we were afraid of serial killers. So obviously the show's about serial killers. Now you're afraid of terrorists. Now you're afraid of, you know, sort of random acts of violence. Now you're afraid of politically motivated extremists, or you're afraid of people in vans, that sort of stuff. But fear is very much part of the fabric of how we live. And it leads us as a society, perhaps, maybe, you know, again, I don't want to get too political, but sometimes it leads us to make bad decisions, I would argue. Mm. I don't think that's a controversial take, but maybe it is. And Carter's aware of that, right? Which is one of the interesting things. But watching the first season of Millennium, there's also the push and pull of like the show on one hand saying, fear is terrible. Society's trying to make us afraid. That's just making things worse and leading to a breakdown of civil order. That's what Millennium's saying the first half of the first season, saying on one hand. And on the other hand, it's like, geez, isn't the world freaking terrifying? Look at how scary it is. There's monsters out there. And there's kind of that weird push and pull that I makes me a little bit uncomfortable with the first half of the first season. I think it gets better as it goes. I think that Morgan and Wong like do some clever stuff with that in the second. But how do you feel about that? That kind of push and pull between, you know, fear is a terrible thing. We shouldn't be so afraid. But on the other hand, people are going to come into your house and murder you, Kurt.
Well, they are, and it's, I mean, you only have to look at in some ways the execution on death row of Ted Bundy. That was like what, 1989, 1990. That during that whole period, the fact that Ted Bundy didn't or wouldn't accept the killings that he did, and he must be what 30-odd, 40-odd people that he killed, and at that time the press were all over the place when he was in the death chair, and then you've got there's all these teenagers coming up and really kind of like pushing the envelope of what television could do, because they were going up there with banners and for badges and all this type of thing, you know, celebrating the fact that, you know, Ted Bundy was going to die, and a lot of the natural fears of that were, especially that kind of age, because, you know, back in the late 70s when he did murder all those women, they were all 18 to 21 year old women, they're all around their age, and that fear must have permeated by the time you get to 96 97, and as you say, the Manson stuff as well, and I think the even like sort of the development of 90s television, that, you know, we're getting 24-hour news, that sort of thing, it made the world more global. And I think that was had probably had a major impact on the way that it was pushed with Millennium. The fact, as you say, you know, doors open and you know, anyone could be the next Ted Bundy. And yeah, I think, I quite like dark aspects of programs and TV and films anyway, so I quite like the way that it was portrayed, but it was potentially a bit, the balance wasn't quite right. I would probably agree with you on that. It needed to be pulled back a little bit.
Now, I mean, again, like I'm being entirely, like, I love Millennium. I don't want to seem like I'm being overly critical or too harsh here, but it's something that I do particularly, and again, it's something I think that you're right, maybe the balance wasn't quite right. Again, this is the early first season. You're still figuring it out. But it's that push and pull dichotomy where Carter is making this very valid point about how scared we are of the world. And it comes up again and again and again over the course of the season. You have like episodes about walled communities, for example. You have episodes about people who have locked themselves in their house with their high-tech alarm system and how absurd that is. And like, the point of those episodes in many cases seems to be, look at how fear has like locked you up inside a cage and there's a monster trapped in there with you, right? Which is a very valid point. But at the end of the day, it's also not a point that I think lands as well as it might when there is always a monster in the cage with you.
Yeah.
Like the problem isn't that you're locking yourself in a cage. The problem is that the monster got in there first, in some senses, I think, perhaps.
Mm, mm. Yeah, and we look at Tombs on that point of view, can't you? Because Tombs from The X-Files obviously did that effectively with the home invasion kind of thought process behind that episode, yeah. So yeah, I definitely, it's something to ponder on, absolutely. Right, so where were we? So we have Frank, at this point, he goes back home and consults the Bible, and this is where he consults Catherine. It's one of the scenes that we talked about earlier, that he consults Catherine, whether or not it's a bad man doing bad things, or is it another form of force that is causing the things to happen, you know, the Holocaust to happen, or is it just the case of bad men? And that question seems to permeate through most of the first season, I would argue. That was where I was kind of getting at with the point that he was open to at that point, that they're having that discussion. What are your thoughts on that whole discussion and some of the Bible context that he placed in there, and the review and the research that he was doing, that he was kind of consulting his old soul in some ways?
Well, I mean, it's all framed in very spiritual terms. And again, I like the idea that Catherine, like, argues that, like, psychology and sort of, like, all, you know, modern science are just ways of, like, expressing primal fears, or ways of exploring something that we've maybe intuitively known, that evil exists in the world, which is a very Chris Carter notion. And again, it's not something that I personally agree with or am entirely comfortable with, this idea that evil exists outside itself. I think there's one of the shorts that's nominated for the Oscars, Detainment, tries to tackle this idea as well, with the Bulger killing, in a way that was maybe not as tactful as it needs to be.
Yeah,
to say the very, very least of that. But it, again, like, that sort of points to the fact that this is a debate that's, like, you know, Catherine's right, it's a debate that's been taking place since the dawn of time, but it's a debate that's still very relevant, and it's a big idea, and I absolutely love when Carter goes and swings the fences with these big ideas. Like, I don't entirely agree with Carter's conception of evil personally, but I think that he makes a very strong argument for it. And I quite like it as a poetic concept, as, like, an abstract kind of artistic construct, the idea of evil as something that flows through us. And again, this is something that comes up in The X-Files repeatedly, with, say, the black oil, the way the black oil gets inside of you and changes you. Mm. Even stuff like the way in which evil passes from person to person. In certain cases, I'm thinking of, like, the episodes like Grotesque or Empedocles in the 8th season, where Mulder again describes it as a virus. And it's telling that Carter again comes back time and time again to the virus as a metaphor for whatever it is that he's, you know, sort of dealing with that week. Again, the 90s, you can't, you know, have that sort of virus without worrying about AIDS, for example, or even Ebola. But, like, Carter's idea of evil as something that's viral and infectious, and again, worth noting that I think even the pilot to Millennium, you have the Great Plague in the Maritime City, that sort of fear simmering through that as well. But I like the idea, even if I don't agree with it, of evil as something external to us, something, because in that is this great humanism, right? So if Frank believes that evil is something that exists outside of an individual, outside of you and outside of me. And again, he has that great discussion with Atkins, where Atkins is like, I've seen the face of evil, Frank. I've looked into its eyes, seen it staring back at me. The face has always been a man's face, a human face. I always believe that evil is born in a cold heart and a weak mind. And the episode kind of lets you know what it thinks of Atkins' theory by shoving him in a microwave and being like, well, there's your theory done with. But again, like, if that is the case, right, and as dark and as grim as Millennium can be, and it can be very dark and very grim, there's a belief that people are fundamentally good in there, in that, like, Frank's philosophy, if Frank comes to believe that evil is something that exists outside of people, means that people are inherently and intrinsically good, left to their own devices. If you could remove evil from the world, and in this case, if evil is in the form of demons, in the form of, like, these predatory entities, in the form of maybe Lucy Butler, kind of later on as the show develops, then it's something that can be isolated. If it's a virus, it can be treated, it can be cured, it can be removed. You can be immunized against it. And there's something almost kind of heartwarming in that. And again, that's an idea that's very similar to, again, to Frank's idea of the Yellow House as a place that he can keep pure, and a place that he can keep separate and uncontaminated by the world outside it, by the evil lurking outside it. And there's something very poetic in that, and again, in the same way Carter's a very poetic writer, in the same way that he writes Mulder and Scully as sort of like a chaste couple, which admittedly infuriates, and understandably infuriates, a significant portion of fans. But there's something very, like, Chris Carter medieval poet writing for 90s television in the way that he does that. And I kind of admire that. I dig that, if that makes sense.
You mentioned Butler there. It's one of the things I was going to come to. I mean, we aren't getting there just yet because of the season's yet to run. But there is an element of the Legion mythology that people take from this. And this was probably the first episode that did it. And you've got, obviously, Clement, who looks at Frank right at the end scene, towards the end there, which we'll jump to shortly. But you've also got Lucy Butler and the Judge, as well as three characters there who have this Legion-esque mythology that's running through the season. But it doesn't seem like they're 100% committed to that aspect of it. What were your opinions and thoughts on whether or not, do you think that they did that on purpose, or do you think that it kind of like shifted a different way? I know that Morgan won obviously take over in season two and they go a separate way. And Lucy Butler's dealt with three different times in three very different ways. But there was that idea of the Legion mythology kind of kicking in even as early as here. So what were your thoughts on that? And do you think that it was right to kind of not drop it, but kind of just have that going on in the background?
Well, I mean, it's worth noting, like, in terms of how Carter writes mythology, myth arcs, and again, like, Carter himself has been sort of, like, very honest about, like, he didn't set out and write the X-Files with a 9-year plan. Mm. And again, there are some people who are going, damn right, looking at how it turned out. But I mean, Carter tended to play it by ear as he was going. He would develop ideas as he was going along, and he'd integrate them and he'd play with them. And again, you can see that in certain ways in the way that Carter keeps coming back to particular ideas over and over again. Like, so for example, you know, the pilot to Millennium has these men who have their eyes sewn shut and who are lit on fire, which he'd used like a year and a half later in Patient X and sort of The Red and the Black. So like Carter, you know, he was very ad hoc in terms of plotting this stuff. But if you look at things like, say, the X-Files mythology, as much as that's an iconic part of the show, in the first season, it wasn't really there. Yeah. The episodes that we think of as mythology episodes in the first season of The X-Files are The Pilot, Deep Throat, EBE, Fallen Angel, The Erlenmeyer Flask, maybe Conduit with a little asterisk next to it, that sort of stuff, or maybe anything that Deep Throat shows up in. And, you know, that episode where William B. Davies is leaning down to talk to Monster of the Week as he's dying. And it's like, it doesn't really exist. It hasn't properly been codified, because Carter hadn't decided that what exactly he was going to do with them. He just had a bunch of cool ideas. I was like, yeah, let's run with those. And the second season, you have stuff like he hones it a little bit further. And then it's only in the third season. And I think that, like, again, to Chris Knowles, who knows much more about the inner workings of the X-Files writers' room than I do, would credit, like, Frank Spotnitz as somebody who helped impose a sense of structure on some of those ideas with Carter, in collaboration with Carter, and sort of helped shape the mythology as we understand it today. And so I wonder, watching the first season of Millennium, if something similar was at play, where it was quite literally like Carter had these ideas that he was like, yep, I like this notion. I like this notion. Legion is like a cool concept from, you know, sort of demonology. You know, I'm very interested in Christian imagery, so we can stick that in there. And what if, like, it's a literal devil? What if he just sees a literal devil? And I will say, though, that, like, you point to Lucy Butler. Lucy Butler appears in there's a two-parter later in the season where Carter and his writers very, very firmly kind of commit to the idea of, like, something much bigger at work, and in particular, something much bigger interested in what Frank's doing. That is like, it reminds me a lot of like a second season two-parter from The X-Files of like Colony or Endgame. And I kind of wonder if like Carter was like accelerating along those lines. So I wonder if we might have seen a more kind of codified or a more rigidly defined Legion mythology if Carter had not had to like focus on running the fifth season of The X-Files and had to hand over the reins to kind of two other producers for the second season.
Yeah.
And again, I say that I wouldn't trade the second season of Millennium for the world.
No, absolutely.
And I certainly, yeah, certainly wouldn't trade the first half of the first season either. But I do wonder if like, I don't know if Carter was like, I'm going to intentionally leave this vague, or if Carter's like, well, this is a cool concept, maybe I'll come back to it later. It is worth noting, I actually really like the vagueness of the Legion mythology.
Yeah.
And again, it's kind of like, it's just great. And again, we talked about like the great thing about Millennium is this is 20 years after the show, Kurt, and we're still arguing over, like, first principles of, like, a shared central story arc. And again, to some people that might be infuriating, I kind of love it. I love that, like, I watch Millennium, and one time I watch it, I come away and I'm like, yeah, there's definitely some sort of evil that's singly at force throughout the entire run of the show. And other points I'm like, maybe there's a bunch of different evils. I have no idea what's going on. And I kind of like that the show can do that, because it gives me freedom to make my own interpretation, but also other people's interpretations. Again, I mentioned earlier, like, one of the great things about this podcast is going to be listening to people who are talking about episodes like The Judge, who are talking about, you know, episodes like Lamentation and Power of Principality, Stones of Dominions, and trying to make sense of them. And I suspect that, like, a lot of them will have different theories. Yeah. And I don't think any of them will be right or wrong. I just think they'll all be fascinating. And I imagine that some of them will be brilliant. And I kind of am very excited about that.
You've got that aspect of, you know, you can make your own mind up, or you can decide what you want it to be.
Yeah.
And that's what I love about The X-Files as much as anything, the fact that, you know, things are open to interpretation. And you're right that some people will say, you know, oh, I just want the answers, and they just want the answers now. And I'm not that way. I don't like procedural television that wraps it all up in a bow every single week. And I need that thought process of, you know, what could have happened, or what was that, how was that? And that's really important to me. So this is one of the reasons, as you say, about the Millennium podcast that we're on here, that it's going to be a really interesting take over the three seasons and how people deal with that. We are getting towards the end of the episode. We see the security camera. Mike gets...
He gets microwaved.
Did you have to go there? So he gets microwaved.
I mean, no, I'm not... Can I get through the entire episode without making a few bad puns?
Well, yeah, I mean, between yourself and Carl Sweeney for the puns, you're definitely battling for first place with him. So, yes, we do see the rifles. We do see the phone call that Mike makes to Frank, as Frank's making the connections with Gehenna and Gehenna Industrial and the San Francisco site, and that's where Mike goes to. And... you get the Frank phoning Mike back and then disappearing, the whole Melissa Scully trick, where he tries to phone back and that doesn't happen. And then as we say, gets microwaved. I'll give you that. He sees an open microwave door and walks into it.
Which is amazing. Like, for like a veteran FBI agent. Like, I mean...
No police backup. Just go. First of all, goes to a rainy, darkened industrial site where there's no one around, that a suspected cult person who's and a serial killer around, that you see an open microwave, which you know, because you've been there, that, you know, people are being burnt alive, and there's 36 pounds of, like, body waste, ash. And that's the equivalent of 7 people, that you see an open microwave and you walk into it. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's a bold strategy, Kurt. Let's see if it pays off.
So that comes to the end of the episode. Mike actually does survive, and he does end up in another episode later in the season, as it happens. So
yeah,
he does survive, and you know, all is well.
I guess this case was just small fry, eh?
Yeah, it gets me from the insides, absolutely. So
any more burning questions?
There might well be one burning question. I'm talking about Roger Clement. The very end of the episode, we get Bob Wilde, who actually turns up again in season 3 as the he's a character to in season 3. It becomes quite a reoccurring character, doesn't he? Bob Wilde, who plays Clement.
Yeah.
So we've got him who stares at Frank, and to be fair, that is probably the most scariest thing that you're ever going to see. The way that stares and the reflection of Frank Black is beautifully shot. I mean, I think David Nutt has done a fantastic job there. Yeah. And then again, at the very end, we get Catherine saying, Frank at the end of the scene, and a lovely wide shot of them asking, you know, did he get the bad man? And Frank saying, I'm not sure that the bad man can be caught. And the episode ends at that point. What are your final thoughts on that scene and obviously the microwave scene and Frank Frank then going to the hospital and those final words rolling into the credits and the end of the second episode?
Well, I mean, it's very clear that the Millennium Group obviously has really, really great healthcare coverage, if we're being entirely honest. It is kind of interesting, actually, that you mentioned that, again, Mike does turn up in a later episode. And again, you have Chris Elliott as well in a supporting role as well, as another group member. And even Terry O'Quinn as Peter, as well. But, I mean, the thing is that none of those characters seem particularly well defined as individuals. I think it's mentioned that, like, Atkins came up from a fishing trip. And that's about as much personality as any of the group members get. And it's kind of, it's weird because it feels like, and again, you're always going to be comparing this show with The X-Files. But like, you look at The X-Files and you look at, like, you know, how Skinner came to be defined, how all the lone gunmen came to be defined, how Krycek came to be defined, how all these characters sort of developed their own personalities. And obviously Peter in Millennium turns into one of the best characters in, like, the 10-13 wheelhouse, I would argue.
Yeah.
You know, again, there's some debate about whether you should count the third season when you say that Peter is one of the best developed characters in that sort of, like, in the entire franchise. But, like, over the course of the first and second seasons, Peter is just, he's amazing and he's fantastic. And it's kind of weird watching him here in Gehenna where he's just, he's an exposition machine, really. Mm. And not only is he an exposition machine, he's one of three exposition machines who exist in the episode, which is a really strange redundancy to have in, like, your second, in the episode after the pilot. But I do think you're right, by the way, in the interrogation scene, that Nutter's direction is fantastic here.
Mm.
It looks really, really good. Nutter was one of the best directors the X-Files, and I mean Millennium as well, looking at the two that he did, ever had. And I think, yeah, the show owes a massive amount to Nutter in terms of how it looks and feels. Obviously, you get Wright later on, who becomes the defining directorial voice on the show. But again, Nutter sort of really establishes a template. It looks really moody and really dark and really effective throughout.
Mm, absolutely. Well, I think that comes to the end of the episode, unless you have anything further you want to ask, say, or do.
No, I think that about sums it up, Kurt.
Fantastic. Well, I'll get your credit card details after we come off air, and those hair products will be with you shortly.
Very good. Create desire, Kurt. Create desire.
I will, absolutely. I've got it on my wall as we speak. It's there constantly going through my mind. So, how can people find you online, Darren?
So yeah, in terms of finding me online, you can find me online at Twitter at Darren_Mooney. I also co-host another podcast called The 250 with my friend Andrew Quinn. And what we do is we go through the IMDb's top 250 movies of all time, one at a time, once a week, for apparently ever, because they keep adding new movies to the list and taking old ones out. I also co-host another podcast, The Scanon Podcast, which is an Irish film criticism podcast, with a bunch of friends. So basically a bunch of people who are very smart and know a lot about Irish films, and myself, who's there as a ringer, talk about the week in film, including the top 10, the new releases, and what we watched this week. So it's an interesting one if you're looking for, like, a weekly dose of sort of, like, film-centric discussion. So it's kind of fun and broad in that sort of way.
So thank you very much for coming on, Darren. It's much appreciated. In the meantime, you can find me online. My name is Kurt, and my handle is on Twitter at rmuldrake. That's rmuldrake. So in the meantime, thank you all for joining in and listening to the second episode of The Time Is Now. But until next time, this is who we are.
The Time Is Now, a Millennium podcast, was created by Tony Black, who co-produces alongside Kurt North. You can find the show on Twitter at The Time Is Now Pod, and on Facebook if you type in The Time Is Now. Plus, we have a Facebook fan group called The Yellow House, full of active Millennium discussion. The Time Is Now is also part of the We Made This podcast network at We Made This Pod, alongside a range of popular culture shows about TV, film, music, and beyond, including our sister show, The X-Cast, an X-Files podcast. For advance access to The Time Is Now and access to bonus material, consider supporting The X-Cast and We Made This on Patreon at patreon.com/The X-Cast. That's patreon.com/The X-Cast. You'll find a full range of subscription tiers available. Thanks for listening.